The material provided today is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered legal or financial advice. Consult with a financial professional for your own needs. John E. Sestina & Company disclaims any and all liability for the interpretation and use of the content provided today.
I need help getting out of my student loan debt.
I'm so worried. How am I going to afford taking care of my parents?
When's a good time to get into the market?
I'm really not sure when I should start taking my Social Security.
I wonder if I have enough insurance.
I wonder when I can retire.
It's time to talk about your money, managing to be wealthy. Our team of fee-only financial planners is ready to help you create better financial habits, envision your long-term goals, and understand money management better than ever. Our resident hosts of John E. Sestina & Company are on deck to show you the way.
Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Tracy Bennett. With me today are certified financial planners Stephen Lucan and Tony Payne. And today we're talking about how wages affect the American economy. And I kind of handpicked the two of you for this conversation.
Oh, thank you. All right.
Especially the combo.
Well, at least you got the smart one here. So.
We've got the econ brain.
Sorry about yourself again.
Yep. So in the last three or four years, there's been a lot of speculation, at least from the everyman mindset, why wages aren't keeping up. You can blame it on various things. And those of us who don't understand it, and it's way above our head, I'd like to kind of get into the weeds a little bit. So I want to first discuss some of the ways in which wages affect the economy, just kind of bullet point, and then we'll just kind of dig down a little bit.
Okay.
Just start riffing.
All right.
So Tony, I'll start with you.
Okay. It's great to be here with you. So this is going to be fun.
All right.
You're starting with me.
I'm starting with you.
Okay, let's
hear it. You're on the hot seat.
Let's see what you got.
So give me one way in which wages affect the economy.
Well, the biggest way, and this is huge, is consumer spending represents almost 70% of GDP. I mean, it's, I think, 68% or something at the last report. So if you think about wages or how people are able to spend that are consumers, well, that drives everything. So if you're not having wages increase or you don't have wage growth, well, there's your GDP growth, at least 70% of it. So I think that's probably the big one that comes to my mind.
Steven?
He stole mine.
Uh-oh. Darn it. I caught
that's
off
exactly
your paper.
It, right? The consumer drives the bus, which is our economy. So without wages, you then have savings, but you need wages to build savings. So, that's the most important thing.
Stopping there for a second. During COVID, and I'm not an econ brain, so forgive me if I sound illiterate about this, but I've had these conversations with people during COVID, trying to figure out how people had money to. They were blowing up the stores at one point,
okay,
and yet the salaries had not been increased early on in the game, and they were still shopping and they were still spending. We would go out, we would see people eating in restaurants, and yet they were talking about inflation. You know, and the people can't afford to do those things, but we were watching people do them all around us. I mean, and we can get further into that conversation, but that's something that always confounded me, you know, as just an average person.
Well, if you're talking during the pandemic, there were certain phases, right? The first was the shutdown of the economy where everyone was said, stay home, mm-hmm. right? Nobody go anywhere. Everyone stay home. And that was a good month or two. I can't remember,
yeah,
but
yeah,
it seemed
right.
like a year, yeah. but yeah. it was a few months, right? It took a while. And basically, what did you see? What I saw is my credit card bill shrunk to pretty much nothing because most of my credit card travel, right? Restaurants didn't happen. You might have done a couple carryouts, but people were stuck at home.
You're not an Amazon shopper?
No.
Okay.
But most people, you saw consumer spending drop significantly. So people built up a cash.
Yeah.
They built it up, and their cash savings and their spending went down. Then when we started to release the consumer and say, okay, now we can start. We had already gotten stimulus checks, child tax credits. People got a little bit of money and it built up. And then they had large bank accounts. And when you have a large bank account, I'm as guilty as anybody. When my checking account is full and robust, I'm a little loose.
Are
with
you
my
a spender?
When it's there,
yeah.
When it's in my checking account, I'm a little loose with the credit card. So I structure my finances to not have that happen. But people got nuts. They spent a lot of money in other areas, and that's triggered the inflation, right? That started to trigger inflation, consumer spending, because inflation is driven by the consumer who spends too many dollars, full bank accounts chasing too few of goods.
Yeah, to say it a different way, too. I mean, you're on it. I mean, the idea, too, of...
We'll take that on here.
If we're thinking about it, it's not so much that the money flow changed, the money coming in changed. It disrupted for some people, certainly. But like you were saying, Stephen, depending upon where you were, the income side might have been coming in, but the expense side, maybe it got distorted. Maybe it didn't even change how much, but instead of going out or going to travel, hey, I want to make the house a little nicer. Hey, during this span, I want to be able to go on a nice beach vacation and rent a place in the middle of nowhere and not be by people. And one of the big ones we saw were all the toys. I mean, you had such a low interest rate, money that would have been going towards some things. I mean, if you think about it before
it's
the
like
pandemic,
RVs, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a negative savings rate. So people were actually putting more on the cards, more on debt, and that would help grow the economy. That's part of the consumer economy. And then as Stephen was saying, when it slowed down, that savings rate spiked almost 20%, which is really abnormal. Usually it's more like 3-4%. So I think all those things combined is where we could look out and say, hey, where's all this money coming from? But it just wasn't going somewhere else, I think.
Correct.
So inflation, so cost push inflation versus demand pull inflation is what you're talking about, right?
A little bit. I mean, we can use those technical terms. I like those, but really it's more about
and
just distortion.
By the way, I have no idea what that means. I just read it. So for those out there who think I'm some kind of a genius, it's not. It's not it.
I like the word distortion. I mean, that's what it is. And then people go back to normal.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look now, and it's kind of funny because I've subscribed and followed a couple newsletters, and at the beginning of the pandemic, you're looking at things, and in the middle, boats, used boats, 1990s boats that you couldn't give away before. All of a sudden, people wanted 10, 20,000, which was abnormally high and unreasonable in a normal market. Well, now things are coming back down where these boat manufacturers thought the pandemic may not end. They ordered so many, and now they're sitting there. Interest rates went up instead of down. It's a distortion.
Okay.
I mean, people are spending more on food now because of that. But
yeah, cars,
the toys are
RVs. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People were selling used cars for more than what
they would get
for a new one at that point, right?
Yeah. So, again, that's how the consumer impacts the economy. And all the money where it was being focused was a demand side, right? High demand, high prices. So cause and effect there.
When remember that span for a couple of days when oil actually went
negative?
I mean, there were so many tankers in the Gulf waiting to offload at once that you actually were almost paid to unload that oil for them. So if you think about that distortion of even the gasoline that people would have normally been buying, that went somewhere else too.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I mean, remember driving on take a ride on the interstate? I was shocked coming to the office. The roads were empty.
Right.
It was scary.
Right.
For
a long time.
And it's even just now coming back to normal, I think, this summer.
It's very cool to see people out and spending money. I don't gripe anymore about waiting for a table at a restaurant because I'm just glad to see
to have a table available
there.
Yeah.
Restaurants.
And we'll get into this installation side, but the consumer is the economy. 70%, as Tony said, approximately 70%.
Stephen, you and I were talking about the job situation as it pertains to wages in the economy. So, talking about employment. Let's kind of break that down for people.
Yeah. It's hard, and this is where it can get very dicey because I don't want to sound crass. Let's go through the phases of life, right, where before you graduate from college, you're doing your whatever job necessary if you need a job, waiting tables or whatever it might be, just to get by, hopefully pay a little bit of college. And then you get your degree, and now you're in your 20s. You're fighting and clawing, trying to climb the corporate ladder. Now, life can get in the way, too, when you're in your 20s and 30s, getting married, the relationships, kids, and so forth. So that's why I don't want to sound this is what you have to do. But you have to fight. You have to fight, keep climbing, keep trying to increase those wages. And then by the time you're in your third, get to about 30, 35, you might have enough increase in your wages that you can start to save a little bit more and build that financial nest egg, which is very, very important. You get into your 40s and 50s. Now you're really at your prime, right? You're in your prime earning years in your 40s and 50s. You may demand a higher salary or earn a higher salary, the higher salaries of your life, but you have to start to be careful at this point where you could become too expensive for your employer, because you're almost too good for them. Now you're very costly, and they may find a way. Can you be replaced by somebody who's significantly younger and less expensive? So it's that balance. You have to fight and claw with your wage history and earnings, and then you got to be careful when you start to make too much that you may become expendable because you're too expensive.
How do you fix that? I mean, just continue to professionally develop?
I think it's part of what we do with our planning.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that you described it right. I think of it. I mean, and like you said, there's leeway for a lot of different things. Life's going to happen, and it happens to people in different ways. But, I mean, I think about it, and I kind of smile. You and I might be unemployable nowadays
right.
because we stayed at the same place for 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And what they'd like to see is a little bit more hopping around, a little bit more climbing that ladder, going for that next best position. So that is part of it. And that idea of even corporate loyalty, I mean, I think you and I know it. When things are bad and a recession happens, you are a number on paper to that company. Mm-hmm. When times are good and you're loyal and you've been there 20 years, you might feel that loyalty. But when things go bad, that's where it's really important to have your plan in order, and kind of back to what we do and what we help people with. When times are good and when you're climbing that corporate ladder, keep be squirreling something aside for yourself. Mm-hmm. Put something aside, whether it's for retirement, whether it's for maybe losing that job or income changing. I mean, it sounds kind of basic, but those are the things that at least can buy you some time to find the next best thing.
Yeah, and most people don't want, they don't, I understand why they think this way, because I'd be the same way, is that would never happen to me, or that will never happen to my company that I work for, which in theory, yes. But as Tony said, when times get tough, you become a number. And things that I've seen, people don't get fired. They eliminate the position. Right? How cowardly is that? But that's a way they can get around it. Here's a severance package. Your position has been eliminated. They didn't fire you.
Right. It's not
they
personal,
eliminated
but
the
it
position.
Feels, you're, when you're
right.
with a company, now you're dealing with basic human behavior.
Correct.
Because that feels personal.
Yeah.
So that's got to be, you know, a real gut punch.
Right.
You know, you give 20 years of your life to a company and they turn around and say, see ya, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
For
now you're
no
55, 55 years old. You have a standard of living. You have an expectation of income. And you're like, oh, I will not accept another position for anything less than what I had, go try to go find that position.
Yeah.
Right? That's not the easiest thing to do. And now you have a lifestyle, you have a financial plan centered around that income that you had for a long period of time that could be gone.
In the most extreme example, we like sports. If you think about holding out for that contract because you don't know that you're going to get the next one, that's almost the extreme example of what we're talking about. But that put yourself first in some ways is really important, because if you're not doing it, no one else will. And that's what we know and what we've seen through planning.
Yep.
And that's where you can try to protect yourself. I mean, there's still going to be life happens and things that come up, but at least by doing planning, you can be a little bit more prepared.
Right. And then you're in the last chapter. You're in your 60s.
Oh, yeah.
You're just hoping to get to the finish line before the company says time's up, right? And I've had those conversations with people where they're afraid to even bring up the word retirement, because they're afraid to bring it up, and then all of a sudden you're out the door because you brought up. So I always encourage people, maybe can I do 3 or 4 days a week, maybe a 3-day weekend, ease into retirement. And it's nice when you have that financial independence. That's why we always focus on financial independence, where you have enough saved, you're ready to go, and now you're choosing to work.
Right.
And you're 62 years old, you can quit any day. Now you walk into the boss's office and say, hey, I'd like to work 4 days a week. Reduce salary or reduce whatever, or 3 days a week. Is that because you have control? That's the goal. And that's the finish line when you get into your 60s, even 70s possibly.
Isn't there an influx now, though, recently of retirees who are coming back into the workforce and actually being welcomed over and above Gen Z and millennials
possibly.
Because of their work ethic, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
wouldn't surprise me.
Been seeing a lot of media play about that, so...
But then not at the rates of what they would.
What you're used to.
Right.
Yeah.
You're used to. But yeah, it's probably a realistic reality is the work ethic of an older generation.
Mm-hmm.
Not to dismiss the younger generation.
Right.
Right. Because I'm sure people looked at our generation and said, these kids don't work hard.
Exactly.
I know that's reality. But that probably
bunch
implies
of hippies.
It. Right. Right.
Well, yeah. And even the labor participation rate's going up. I mean, it's ticking up ever so slowly, but that's going the right way. And when we think about just, you know, the basics of an economy is made up of people. How many people are there? How old are they? How many new people are coming in? These are things that are really important, too, for the job market, because if you're not having enough young people entering the workforce every year, then wages do start to really climb up and you see some of these distortions. I mean, last year, I think, was the slowest population growth since George Washington was president. So really? If we think about wages and supply and demand, kind of those basic things, mm-hmm. that's also part of wages going up is...
Globally, you know, or for the U.S.?
For the U.S.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
For the U.S.
Okay.
There's other countries that are definitely growing a lot quicker, but
just people are getting married later and having children later. And
or not having children.
Not having children.
Yeah. Exactly.
Used to be you had, you know, 5, 6, 7 kids to help take care of the farm. Or,
and that goes back to my decades of what you... And when you have the family... The job or income is so important to you because you have to feed the family, put food on the table, both husband and wife. That's the priority. That's where you get stuck, right? Mm-hmm. And you find then it becomes what's more important, fighting for the raise mm-hmm. or then potentially exposing myself to being relieved from my position, not having a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And that's the hard part.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't want to sound insensitive to that environment, because family is the most important thing.
Right.
And
right?
I'll come out of left field a little bit on this discussion of wages and income. We know that there's people too, whether they're not that traditional 9-to-5 job or they're in the gig economy or they're doing something on their own in a business, where you can take that choice of taking time off, mm-hmm. being free, taking 6 months to just stay at home and do what you want because you're managing your cash flow properly, you're doing it right. So that's the other side of this, is you don't always have to be locked in the box of what's that next rung on the ladder. If you're saving, if you can buy yourself time, that's what allows you sometimes to really go out there and do something creative, but you've got to have that base plan set up first.
Correct.
How does it at all, Social Security, play a part in all of this for those who are taking Social Security?
And their younger age or older age, once they're receiving it?
Right.
Well, as far as inflation and wages, that increases. You get your annual increase is determined by the government. It's never really in alignment with what real inflation is, but they'll give you something, mm-hmm. 3%, 2%. They keep it pretty modest because the Social Security program is under pressure, mm-hmm. right, for solvency. So they're trying to be as conservative with it as possible.
Is that automatic when that happens? You know, when inflation
it's
goes up,
year.
It's just automatic?
Year to year.
We had the
weighted.
So you don't have to apply for it or anything?
No, right. Yep. We had the 1 year spike where it was almost 8%. But if you remember, that's after all the inflation, like Stephen's saying. So even if it goes up with inflation, you're getting your increase the year after the inflation happened, and that goes back to managing cash flow, having a little bit of a reserve, not being maxed out, hopefully.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to bounce back to salaries and the relationship between salary structures and inflation, because I remember when the minimum wage went up to, $15, $15 and some change, and it still wasn't enough for people because costs of things had increased so radically. How do you fix that?
We have a problem. This country has a big problem. Cost of housing, inflationary cost for housing compared to inflationary rise of wages or earnings, they're disproportionate. It's way out of whack, and we have a big problem. There's no other way to explain it.
No, I mean, again, it's become more and more of a political argument, and that's not where we're here. But the reality is, if you were in the bottom quintile in 1979 compared to today, you're making a lot less compared to those that were at the top half or the top 5%. That's just the numbers. I mean, I can't hide that, but what do you do about that? How can you manage that? That's where the idea of even that $15 figure, that's not worldwide, that's not statewide, that's not even a federal minimum now. I mean, there are things that apply a little differently. You think about even tip jobs,
right,
where there are those ins and outs where, no, you're not keeping up for the most part, and that's where, how have people kept up? Where is that top 5% gaining their wealth? And it's in investments. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that wages and labor, because that's what you have to offer, would be your labor is not keeping up with the pace of investments. So if you were somebody that has more in investments or assets, well, those are going to rise with inflation a lot more than your labor, which is your wages. So that's where if you're able to own things, make investments, that's where that difference from the late 70s until now, I don't think it was some magic conspiracy or something. It's just the nature of investments grew quicker than labor.
Yeah, and controlled inflation is good. That's good for the economy. Controlled, not rampant, out of control inflation. Everything inflates. I try to explain that to clients. Everything in your portfolio inflates, whether it's your earnings, your investments, everything grows, right? So that's what inflation is. So yeah, your investment is growing with it, and you have to build a plan where you have money invested along with your wages, and you hopefully your wages can keep up too. But yeah, everything inflates. Debt inflates because cost of goods inflate, cost of cars, cost of housing, those things you get loans for, they inflate too because it's you have to take a bigger loan.
Yeah, I want to ask about that because I was just recently hearing about, and I don't want to get too far into the mortgage conversation because we could do a whole show about, 14 shows about that, but zero percent down mortgages. My concern is that new home buyers, young home buyers who are trying desperately to buy their first home, and their wages aren't keeping up with inflation, they get a hold of marketing like this, 0% down, you can own your own home. Mm-hmm. And they're not reading the fine print. They're not fully understanding what that means. But it's interesting to me how salaries impact the mortgage industry. Because they're in that way, because they're two separate worlds in my brain.
Yeah.
No, you're right, Tracy. I think you're thinking a lot more clearly than some of the way the world is set up. Because if you're just looking at income or a pay stub, but you're not really looking at the spending, the nature of spending, you know, some of those ratios that can get someone pre-approved for a loan may not be the truth or may not be so healthy depending upon what they're actually doing or spending. So the idea that you might want to dig in a little deeper, customize some of these loans would be great. And normally the reason that can happen is they're backed by Fannie, Freddie, their government. They have to be conforming, basically. And that means you got to check all the boxes. You got to follow the process. So the more that you might have some of that private lending or non-conforming lending, probably the better, because then you could look at things a little differently. But if you can say it's all legal, it's all good, it's good enough, then I think you end up with some of that stuff.
Yeah. Read the fine print.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's affordability, which, as you said, is a whole separate podcast. But yeah, I think the housing cost of housing is a challenge in this country, and people have to make adjustments, which is hard. Again, I don't want to sound crass, but you have to make adjustments. If you're getting out of college, you need a roommate. You get a roommate to help offset some of those costs
and understand what you make is what you make.
Yes. Build a plan around that.
So that's a concept that takes years and years. Mm-hmm. I mean, personally speaking, years to understand what that means.
Yeah.
You know, not extending your income through credit and mm-hmm. living beyond your means. Acknowledging what you make, adjust your living expenses, and deal with it.
We're
going to second job.
Yeah.
Thankfully, too, it seems like the pressure's slowly coming off. Again, hate to make it a political thing, whether it's right or left, but whether it was some of the environmental protections or the water things, or whether it was the, hey, I don't want smaller places or apartments in my backyard, both of those sides really limit housing and growth, let alone some of the zoning issues too. And now you're seeing more communities amend the zoning where you can pack in more people, and I'm saying it that way, but you pack in more people, a little less cars, and a lot more in the walking area, and some of these numbers really change.
How
much housing costs.
Right. So what you're getting at is the suburban monster McMansions out there, right? The people were, that where the building was. It wasn't on the 500 square foot apartments, right? That was not a priority for much of America through government politics.
Again, this is
zoning
a whole,
and bureaucracy.
Whole other show, but I feel like the bust in apartment development is just taking us down a rabbit hole. I mean, eventually those apartments.
What do you mean by bust?
There's so many of them going up.
Oh, yeah.
I read recently where 12% of the apartments that are being built in just central Ohio are only going to accommodate.
Oh, yeah.
The 10 years of growth in the population.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that going to look like in 10 years? And then beyond that, are they going to be sitting idle as people move out and buy homes,
but this comes down to, just like inflation is better than deflation, a growing economy, Central Ohio, you'd rather be in a growing economy than a declining economy.
Is that what that means?
You got to keep going.
I mean, apartments, not everything. Not starter everything. Homes, apartments. Everything.
And it is cultural, though. I mean, what's wrong with an apartment, I guess? And that's what I think we've kind of been trained to. But the idea of you're packing more people in, you're getting more density, you're able to raise more money from your police and fire through property tax or income versus having minimum quarter acre lots, or in some communities, a minimum of an acre lot, where how many houses are you really going to build there? How many people can you accommodate? Kind of like what you were saying, Stephen. So with that blend of changing the zoning a little bit, and, you know, some of those property tax incentives really work too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what we're seeing with some of this, with the development, where if you were looking at margins, those houses you mentioned, Stephen, I mean, 30% on $500,000 is a lot better than 30% on $150,000. So that's where, unless there's that real incentive, it's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you're right. You're seeing a lot of zoning changes, right? I see it a lot here locally, and I'm sure it's happening in other cities too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Stagnant wages. Some people have to deal with stagnant wages. Let's talk about what that means, and what does that mean for the economy for those people?
So when you have your annual performance review, not speaking to anyone here, thankfully, but for those that might be in some other organizations, and that performance review nets in a 4 cent per hour raise, a 7 cent per hour, maybe a quarter if they're nice. Those are stagnant wages. I mean, you think about, what are you really doing here? I mean, if you multiply that by 2,000, how much did you really increase me here for the year? Those are the kinds of jobs where if you are passive, and sometimes people feel stuck. And that's the real hard part, whether it's health insurance, childcare, having to pay that next mortgage payment. Unless you have that cash reserve, which I keep bringing up, but it's so fundamental in a plan, you can't afford to job shop. You can't afford to go to that next place. Because if you had that review and it was only a nickel or something, hopefully you're getting in that next unemployment line, or that next line for another job, hopefully, or you're applying going, you know what, I know this isn't right, this isn't keeping up. And in some ways, that's on you. Otherwise, they're just going to keep doing that and hoping you accept it.
Yeah.
So you're saying squawk. The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Yeah, that is the way 100%. It works.
Yeah.
Noted. So noted.
Uh-oh. Shouldn't have said that, Steven.
Right. And the other side goes to my other conversation is, don't overextend yourself either, because then you become expendable, too expensive.
Right. So remember that too. Yeah. Good point, Steven. Good point. Yeah. Remember that. You too, behind the camera there.
I don't fall under those categories. I'm good. Let's talk about technology, how it affects job security and income. Mm-hmm. So especially when it comes to inflation, you know, the role of technological advancements, artificial intelligence, how that affects wage structure and labor markets.
Well, yeah, the easiest thing to control is labor, and that's one of your more expensive categories when it comes to your financial statements. So let's go with the fast food industry, mm-hmm. right? We want, how much does somebody make behind the counters? Let's call it ordering your hamburger and fries. You're seeing touchscreens now. You walk up, you hit the touchscreens, and you have one person doing it.
Yeah.
Look at the restaurants and bars. There's a bar somewhere downtown. One person runs the whole shop because you give them your credit card, and then you get a fob. You go pour your beer automatically, and it charges you as you pour it. One person, labor costs are very low, right? So labor costs.
Steven tips himself very generously.
Exactly. I'm a good bartender.
Yeah,
I'm
right?
So you got to be careful. So you're looking at the fast food industry. We're going to see technology. They'd rather invest in $500,000, $1 million in technology than the labor, right? Because that technology will be more efficient, and you got to be careful.
Right.
But then they need people to run those.
Auto industry. A lot less people.
Yep. And that's the trade-off. And you think about it, I mean, there's jobs that I think, unfortunately, have been almost dismissed as, yes, those will be eaten up by AI. That's something that'll just happen. But then there's a lot more. I mean, I've been talking to a couple of our doctors that we work with, and the idea of some of those specialties there, what might be done with AI, what might be done with computers now. I mean, it applies across the wage scale. Mm-hmm. It's not just that some of the, I mean, certainly in the fast food industry, others like that, we might see it a little easier, but it's across the board. So if you were trying to protect yourself from that, or better yet, leverage it, Because hopefully that's the goal, is it is to increase productivity. And if you're staying current and you're trying to figure out how do I best use this in whatever field I'm in, you know, you think about a roofing company being able to use drones and thermals. And if you're really applying that versus that older company that's maybe doing it that traditional way of getting up on the roof to do everything, that those are the kinds of examples I've seen where you might be able to keep up and be able to do even better if you're staying current.
Right.
I feel like we're always going to have a massive population, though, that, that commands and demands the interaction, the actual people
sure.
aspect of any role, any industry.
Right, but the jobs will change. It'll mm-hmm. change. Again, I thought the better comparison, I said it earlier, the auto industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
look how that changed, right? Go back to the early 1900s when they started the production line. Henry Ford did that production line. Then it's all mechanical now mm-hmm. and robot, but somebody's got to service the mechanic.
Right.
So it's less people involved in it, but there
just
are still
different.
Jobs, just different kind of jobs.
We're skipping a slightly messy step in the middle, but
what's that?
There was globalization first.
Okay.
You know, instead of someone doing it, it was someone cheaper
doing it. Yes.
And then you had a machine do it even cheaper than that other person.
Yeah.
And this, again, this is part of the wage disruption that we've seen the last 20 years, 30 years. And even that, to be aware of, that's really important.
Mm-hmm. But think about that. All the sales jobs. I mean, you can buy your car now online.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't even have to go to a car lot anymore. And you used to haggle with a car salesperson,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get the best deal on a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
All the I feel like the sales jobs, you know, in general are the struggled ones, right? The face-to-face people jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so tragic, too, because if you think about it, whether it's a car, a house, I mean, our realtors, our car salespeople, I mean, these are people you get picked on, I know it, but these are some of the biggest purchases of your life.
Mm-hmm.
To have a professional that's gone through it every single day, that's what they do, that's what they're licensed in, I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
And to think that you're going to go on there and do this perfect purchase and have the vehicle shipped from God knows where, pardon me, that can be a little dangerous, and especially if you're not someone where that purchase is insignificant, that could be a really bum deal. Same with a house even.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of having a true salesperson mm-hmm. that is responsive, that listens, mm-hmm. that can really customize things for you, I think that's really the difference too of, you know, I hate to say the haves, have-nots there, but if you're using the tools and you're leveraging that, I think you can succeed. But for those that are maybe a little more passive and the machine seems to take over, well, yeah, it's going to take over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. This has been interesting. One final question for you guys. This is what we do every day, or what you do for our clients every day. So other than really being aware of spending, is there a best practice for people for the changes in wage policies and the labor laws to manage things?
Tony nailed it a few times. Build that cash reserve, right? The fundamentals. Stick to the fundamentals of building cash reserve, putting money towards investments. I read a lot of online stuff, and I do read the comments, which is a lot of times it's a cesspool of information. But a lot of I hear it, you read it, and it's real because these are people typing it. Is, you know, they complain about Wall Street, they complain about investing, they complain, and I'm like, you got to play that game. I don't answer that, but I see it, and I'm like, in my mind, I'm saying, that's the game. You got to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
So the game is, you have to save money, save for retirement.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find a way to make that happen. You have to have the cash reserve, and it'll work itself,
mm-hmm.
right? So build a plan around your income and using the fundamentals that we preach on all of our podcasts and mm-hmm. within our process. That'll be a key to success.
Great.
If there was a simple formula, wages converts to labor, or labor converts to wages, convert that to investments, and then you hopefully can keep up a little better.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I learned
a
lot today.
It was a good
Thanks
topic.
For tuning in today. We hope you'll tune in next time and catch us on the next podcast.
That's a wrap for today's episode of the Managing to Be Wealthy podcast. We help you make the most of your money without any hidden fees or commissions. Remember, the best investment you can make is in yourself and your financial future. Keep listening for more expert advice and tips. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. To schedule a 1-hour complimentary consultation to discuss your financial concerns, visit our website, managingtobewealthy.com.